When you consider the type of leader you want running the country, what qualities and characteristics are at the top of your list? Do you want a strong leader? What does strong mean to you anyway? My guest this hour says the type of strength we sometimes see, where lots of power is concentrated in the hands of a single leader, is not necessarily the type of leadership a country needs. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope you'll join the conversation this hour and tell us, what is good political leadership to you? Who demonstrates it and why? Is it important to be a strong leader, or are there other characteristics our leader should embody instead? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. My guest is Archie Brown, an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and the author of The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. Archie Brown, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, first of all, let's start off with the most important point here. How are we defining strength or a strong leader in the context of this conversation?
I'm defining a strong leader as one who maximizes power in his or her hands, dominates his or her cabinet and political party and the political process. So a real power maximizer. And I argue that, you know, this is not the quality we should most desire in a leader, and many of those people do a lot more harm than good.
Why is that? Why shouldn't we want something like that out of our leaders?
Well, in the United States, of course, the president is constrained in all sorts of ways, and so in a way the problem doesn't arise so much there. Clearly it arises in authoritarian regimes where a more collective leadership is at least a lesser evil than personal dictatorship. You know, you can compare Stalin's Soviet Union with the Soviet Union before and after, or China before and after Mao Zedong. Even though these were authoritarian regimes, they were not as ghastly as they were under Mao and Stalin. And in parliamentary democracies, when prime ministers acquire too much power in their hands, well, there are only 24 hours in a day of even the strongest leader. And so the more decisions that go to them, and this is a point that applies to the United States president as well, the more decisions that go to them, the less time they've got to focus on each one of them. And then quite often, decisions are in reality made by their aides, their advisors, and elected people around them.
Well, when we elect a leader, are we not also electing the people that that leader appoints? So in essence, isn't that okay?
In a parliamentary democracy, people are voting for a party, and the party chooses the leader. So they're not really voting for a prime minister. Some mm-hmm. prime ministers seem to think that people are voting for them. Tony Blair likes to say, I won three elections, but he didn't win three elections. The Labour Party won them, and they're going to win them with or without Blair. In the United States, again, of course, the president has a special position, but you know, he is in some ways less powerful than a European leader, because Congress is so strong and the Supreme Court can stop the president doing things that a court would not be able to stop a government doing in Europe.
So what's wrong with a leader being stronger, or specifically, how is that reflected in domestic policy as opposed to foreign policy?
Well, there are lots of decisions in Britain where the prime minister, if we take, for example, Tony Blair, I mean, he knows absolutely nothing about computing, but he was chairing meetings at which decisions were taken about the computerization of various ministries in Britain. Many of them ended in disaster. He got into areas he didn't know much about. He'd be much better leaving it to the departmental ministers. Foreign policy is a clearer example, because that's where a prime minister tends to be more powerful. And Blair personally took the decision that Britain should join the invasion of Iraq, which turned out to be a disaster, and it was predicted to be a disaster by specialists in the Middle East in this country. But Blair, though he convened a meeting with them, all he wanted was to be assured that removing Saddam Hussein would be removing evil. He wasn't interested in the complexities of Iraq, and we see today that this decision is still coming back to haunt us, both in the United States and in Britain.
How is David Cameron comparing to him in that way?
Well, David Cameron is more constrained than Blair was because he's in a coalition government. The Conservatives didn't win an outright majority, so he's not so all-powerful. But in a way, that's because he can't be. I think a better example of a leader who listens is a collegial leader, but a very effective one, is Angela Merkel in Germany. She's not an overbearing leader at all, but she's certainly effective and holds a coalition together and is the most influential political leader in Europe today.
And, you know, your subtitle of the book here is The Myth of, The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. Tell us more about the myth of the strong leader.
Well, it's a whole series of myths. One of the myths is that leaders are absolutely crucial to winning elections. Well, obviously, in a presidential system, they are pretty important, though even there, you know, one can argue that it wasn't so much Kennedy who won the election over Nixon, but this was an election when the Democrats were liable to win anyway for all sorts of reasons. And equally, one could argue that the Republicans had become so unpopular by the end of the George W. Bush presidency that, you know, whichever of the main Democratic candidates was running would probably have won. But certainly there's a myth in parliamentary democracies that the leader is all important to elections. There's also, you know, the myth that, you know, one person knows best. I find it difficult to understand why in democracies we should think that, you know, one person is the repository of all wisdom. When people are chosen to be party leaders, it's not because party members think they've got a monopoly of wisdom. They're chosen for all sorts of reasons. So collective judgment, I think, is very important, and the more sensible leaders operate in a more collegial way.
You know, looking back at the last few presidential elections here in the United States, being a strong leader is something that many of the candidates are trying to convey, and in fact that they're stronger than the next guy with whom they're competing in the primaries or the general election. And it would seem that they're doing so because they have a sense that the electorate wants a strong leader. So is there a public demand for a strong leader, or are candidates trying to fulfill a need that doesn't exist?
I think there is a public demand for a strong leader. I'm arguing that, you know, it's largely misplaced, that people think that strength of leadership is above all what's required. I think, you know, intelligent, wise leadership we need, collegial, thoughtful leadership, but strength often translates into rash foreign policy actions. You want to show how strong you are on the international scene. And I would commend Obama, for example, for his restraint over Syria, that there isn't any situation in the Middle East that's so bad that the United States can't make it worse by intervening militarily. And by referring this decision to Congress, he was able to get out of another mess, which would have involved supporting people who were, in essence, Islamist extremists against the nasty regime of Assad. But it was a no-win situation. But so often, strength is taken to mean military strength and foreign adventures.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because in the last hour, which of course you didn't hear, but we were talking about President Obama and his foreign policy. One of our guests said that Syria was an example of him being weak on foreign policy, one of many examples in which he's weak on foreign policy. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm wondering if his style, whereupon he's drawn a so-called red line on Syria and then backed away from it, is perceived, though, as weak and therefore insufficient.
Well, that is an example of how people equate strong leadership with military action. I think that Obama was reluctant to intervene in Syria, and he was quite glad of the opportunity to get off that particular hook. I mean, Syria is a disaster, but you can make things even worse for the United States. And then have to bear a lot of moral responsibility for what happens if you intervene militarily. And the record of intervention in the Middle East is a pretty dismal one. Britain also is very much at fault. In 1956, Britain invaded Suez when the Suez Canal was invaded Egypt, when the Suez Canal was nationalized. And at that time, the United States had a president in Eisenhower who was sensible enough to make it clear that he would not bail out Britain, who were getting into a financial mess as a result, unless they got out of Suez. So they got out. They got out of Egypt. But Eisenhower was a very prudent and very cautious leader. Sometimes the people with military experience are among the most cautious in this respect. You could also look at Colin Powell as an example.
Why Colin Powell?
Because he, of the people who were gung-ho about intervening in Iraq, I would say he was the least gung-ho. He was given, he was fed misleading intelligence information, which he presented the UN to his embarrassment later, but that wasn't his fault. He believed it at the time. But he was among the least eager to intervene militarily in Iraq.
You cite polls of Russian citizens who still call Stalin the greatest leader of their country in the 20th century. So what do you think makes strong leaders so popular there?
Well, Russia, I think, is especially guilty, or Russians have been especially guilty of subscribing to this myth of a strong leader. And the myth in this case not being that they're not really strong. They certainly were strong and very powerful, but the myth lies in believing that these are the saviors of the country, that these are the fathers of the people and are great leaders. So there has been a strong tendency in Russia to equate tremendous power and strength, even cruelty and ruthlessness, with great leadership. And Stalin's an example of that. Of course, part of the problem is that, you know, the crimes of Stalin are not given as much publicity as they should. They were given a lot of publicity during the Gorbachev era, and Stalin's popularity went down then quite markedly, but they're given much less publicity now. And so people associate Stalin with the victory in the Second World War, and they forget about the fact, if they ever knew, that he was responsible for the deaths of millions of people totally unnecessarily.
We're talking with Archie Brown. He's an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and the author of The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. And we want to hear from you. Do you vote for someone based on their promise to be a strong leader? Are you looking for strong leadership? Or do you avoid that type of leadership and why? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Archie Brown, an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and the author of The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. We'd love to hear from you. Is strength a good or bad thing in a political figure? How do you define strength yourself? And what traits do you value in a political leader? Who embodies those traits? Tell us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Peter on Facebook says, a strong leader does what they say, takes action over talk, and sticks up for themselves. A strong leader does what they want, unintimidated by opposition or the status quo. A strong leader thinks quickly and comes up with the right answer the first time. Would you agree with that, Archie?
Coming up with the right answer the first time, no. I think that it's better to take a bit of time. Decisions that are made too quickly are frequently foolish ones. Now, let's take a couple of examples of effective leaders. I mean, Nelson Mandela was a wonderful leader. When you consider what he went through, 27 years of imprisonment for fighting for justice for the majority of Africans in South Africa, and yet he was a very collegial leader. He reached out to his captors And within the cabinet that he presided over in South Africa, he had the reputation of being a very good listener. Mikhail Gorbachev in the Soviet Union transformed the Soviet political system and Soviet foreign policy, but he had to act, he had to persuade people in the Politburo, and it wasn't easy to change policy. He couldn't simply dictate the policy, otherwise he'd have been removed, as Nikita Khrushchev was removed in 1964. So there are lots of reasons why leaders should not simply impose their will, but should listen to others and act through persuasion rather than through orders.
Jean in Mount Horeb has called in. Hi, Jean. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I guess I believe that morality is a better trait for, or good morality is a better trait for a leader to have. And I just question whether it's even possible for a leader to be moral with the way the bureaucracy is set up, especially in this country.
What do you mean, Jean? Can you flesh that out a bit? What is standing in the way of morality once you enter the bureaucracy of government?
Well, you have, our foreign policy previously set up and enacted by, previous presidents, and it has set us on a path that seems to preclude, keeping things peaceful. I mean, like you said, we didn't go into Syria because Barack Obama felt that was wrong. And I'm just thinking that the bureaucracy is already set up in this country for intervention and stuff and for things that, we've allowed corporations to take over and run the government. And I'm just wondering if morality is even possible in a leader, or good morality is even possible in a leader.
Thanks, Jean. What do you think about that, Professor Brown?
I think that it can be difficult, that, often in government the choice is between the lesser evil, so that sometimes you can't, choose what's absolutely the optimal way out. For example, it can be very difficult for a leader to stand up to powerful economic interests, especially if that leader has received quite a lot of money from them in the campaign, and this can influence that leader. But I do agree that integrity is extremely important in a leader, and I would look for integrity before I would look for so-called strength.
And, what about that? When we elect candidates, many people look at what their values are, what their principles are, and they vote based on that. But what does power do to one's personal principles once they are in the so-called grind of government? Have you, in your research, been able to figure that out?
I think that leaders do sometimes have to compromise on their principles. After all, President Obama has used drones a lot in Pakistan. A lot of people have been killed. Not all of them were potential terrorists. And I should think this must be very distressing for him, and it can be questioned how effective it is, because it also arouses a lot of opposition and resentment among part of the population of Pakistan. But, this is the kind of compromise a leader finds himself making in office. On the one hand, you've got to fight terrorism, and sometimes you find yourself using weapons which, in an ideal world, you certainly wouldn't want to use.
Bernie in Elkhorn emails, Hitler was a strong leader. Strength is no indication of rightness. We need morally advanced, intelligent leaders. Strength, when in the wrong direction, is bad. So kind of piggybacking on Gene's call there. But what do you have to say about Hitler's leadership style?
Hitler?
Yes.
Did you say Hitler?
Hitler, Adolf Hitler.
That's one of the ultimate examples of strength being to be equated with evil in Hitler's case. He became enormously powerful, and he created the cult of the leader. The Führer Prinzip, the leader principle, that you must obey the leader unquestioningly. And of course, he led Germany to disaster, as well as creating the Holocaust and enormous suffering in Europe. But ultimately, it was a disaster for his own people. And yet, for a time, a majority of Germans bought into this myth of the strong leader. In the late 1930s, Hitler was genuinely popular with a majority of the German population. The terrible suffering for Germans, as well as others during the Second World War, changed that. And post-war Germany, post-war West Germany in the first instance, and now United Germany, has been an exemplary democracy. But people have learned from that terrible experience. But that's really a prime example of how the myth of a strong leader can lead to disaster.
Vince in Elm Grove joins us. Hi, Vince.
Hi. I suppose my main point is that I think the parliamentary system is superior to the one that the U.S. has, primarily because in leadership in a parliamentary system, you have divided the head of state and the head of government. And the head of government has to face their policies every day in parliament. They have to stand up and defend them. And also, under the parliamentary system, the cabinet are elected, their MPs. In our system, we have effectively a four-year constitutional monarch in the sense that he's head of state and head of government. And his cabinet are people who just, they serve at his pleasure. And so you have people like Rumsfeld or McNamara, people who are architects of two major wars, Iraq and Vietnam, who were not elected, who just walked in off the street and then walked away. And again, the president is treated like a monarch. Everywhere he goes, everything virtually has to be shut down. It's a terribly rigid system. If he doesn't have a Congress on his side, he can't get anything done. And as I said, I think under a parliamentary system, you have more than two parties. You have three, four, five parties. As I say, it's a far more flexible system. The prime minister could be gone tomorrow, whereas with the president, you're stuck with the person for 4 years. You can't get rid of them unless you assassinate them or there's an impeachment, which is an enormous constitutional upheaval trying to do that. So I think it's not strange that the rest of the world, Western world at least, has chosen a parliamentary system over our system, because our system, as I say, it tends to be inflexible, and of course, in some of the worst cases, like in Africa, it can lead to dictatorships.
Thanks, Vince. We've got your point. And what's your response to that, Professor Brown? Are parliamentary forms of government a bit more flexible, and do they breed the type of leadership that you're writing about?
I think they've got many advantages. I mean, there is actually a big political science literature on whether countries emerging from authoritarian rule are more likely to become established democracies if they adopt a parliamentary system than if they adopt a presidential system. Still some argument about it, but on the whole, the argument has tended to suggest that a parliamentary system is more likely to lead to consolidated democracy. Certainly there are advantages in separating the headship of state from the head of government. The Queen in Britain is treated with great respect on the whole, and the Prime Minister can be treated with some disdain and can be criticised very severely. A press conference of a British Prime Minister is nothing like as deferential as most press conferences with an American president would be. But, of course, I don't think Andy's going to be able to change the American Constitution anytime soon, especially since it would need the unanimous agreement of every state. So I think that clearly this system will continue in the United States. And though I agree with almost everything that your caller said, I don't quite agree that it's easy to get rid of the appointees of the president. There isn't a very frequent dismissal of secretaries of state or treasury secretaries. They tend to be there until they want to resign themselves. Whereas in parliamentary systems, prime ministers sometimes dismiss ministers, and they can all change them too quickly. Indeed, there is an argument that in Britain, ministers are not given a long enough time in their departmental office, and this is not very efficient. But on the whole, I think there is quite a lot to be said for a parliamentary system and all the members of the cabinet being themselves elected politicians.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Archie Brown, an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and author of the new book, The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. What leaders have you admired and do you admire? And what qualities, what traits do they possess that make you admire them? 800-642-1234. Ben in Rhinelander is with us. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. How are you? And thanks, Professor Brown, for your input. Question for you. So I tend to think of leaders, the reason democratic societies vote for leaders is for two reasons. One is perhaps we think our leaders or our elected officials, we vote for them because we think they're smarter than us or that they have people managing abilities that are better than us or access to knowledge that are better than us. So we trust them to make good decisions for us when they're in office. Or two, other people prefer to vote for leaders because they want them to be as close a mirror of their constituents as possible, going along with the opinions and values of their constituents. So kind of a dichotomy there. So my question to the professor is, are those two categories kind of reasonable? And if so, from your research and what you've studied, do most democratic societies follow the first or the second, or is it fairly an even balance?
Well, it's a good question, and there is a tension between reflecting the views of your constituents and leading. So I'm not against leadership, you know, leaders trying to inspire people or trying to persuade them or trying to change the minds of the electorate. I mean, if you look at this country, for example, on capital punishment, the House of Commons voted to abolish capital punishment at a time when a majority of people in this country still favored it, and opinion has gradually come round against it. Or if you look at President Obama today trying to influence opinion on the gun laws in the United States, I mean, he's clearly ahead of opinion on this issue, but again, you can contrast the European countries where a few hundred people a year are killed or murdered with the figures in America. Most American major American cities have got a higher number of violent deaths in a year than a European country. So President Obama is trying to make this case. And that's reasonable, but of course he can't dictate. He has to try to persuade, and that's part of the role of a leader.
You write that the United States is unlikely to see a transformational leader in modern times. Why do you say that?
I say that because of the constraints on the power of the American president. I mean, I do have a category of transformational leaders, people who actually change the system they inherit or play a decisive role in changing the system. So Deng Xiaoping in China played a decisive role in changing the Chinese economic system. Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, the major role in changing the Soviet political system. But in the United States, you know, given the power of Congress, given the veto power of the Supreme Court and a number of what are essentially political issues, and given the power of the 50 states, the president couldn't really introduce systemic change. I've got another category, just one level down from transformational leader, and that's a redefining leader, somebody who redefines the limits of the possible. And you can find American presidents in the 20th century who've done that. I mean, FDR, Roosevelt undoubtedly did so with the New Deal. And I would argue Lyndon Johnson also was a redefining president because in spite of the tragedy of Vietnam, where he got out of his depth, the legislation he got through Congress included things that Kennedy could never have got through. So in civil rights and the war on poverty, I would regard Johnson as a redefining leader. Mm-hmm. But that's not quite a transformational leader, which would mean transforming the very essence of the system.
Well, and for that, your prime example is Abraham Lincoln. Tell us more about why he was able to be a transformational president during his time.
Yes, he would be the last American transformational leader, in my view. And, of course, at a time of acute crisis, in some ways makes more possible great change. And the in a sense, the Union was reestablished on a new basis under Lincoln, but at a time when the Union could have broken up, he had the opportunity to become, in essence, a transformational leader. And he was a fine example of somebody who was collegial, who was inclusive. You know, we know from the recent literature and the film of the book how inclusive his style was, bringing in his principal rivals into mm-hmm. his team. But that was a fine combination of giving a lead and yet listening to others and being collegial.
So what would it take to become transformational today? I guess it's a two-part question. What's changed about the office of the presidency since President Lincoln was in office up to today? And what still stands in the way of a president specifically to be more transformational?
I think that it's not so much the change from 19th to 20th century or to 21st century as the fact that, you know, the United States was in a crisis. I mean, civil war was obviously something quite exceptional. But there are other great changes, of course, and one is the United States' role in international politics, and linked to that, the tremendous increase in speed of communications, because the telephone, air transport, internet, all these things mean that heads of government can be in touch with each other instantly. And, you know, in the 1930s, it was very rare for, recently, it's the 1930s, it was very rare for heads of government to meet personally to try to settle issues. This was usually done by ambassadors or foreign ministers. So when the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, went to meet Hitler, it didn't do any good, of course, but he did it. But that was very unusual. Now, of course, the American president is tremendously involved in foreign policy because the United States is the strongest military power and the most influential political actor on the international stage. So this has affected the president. To that extent, the president's got less time to focus on all the domestic issues because he must give a lot of attention to foreign policy.
We're talking with Archie Brown. He's an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and author of the book, The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. We want to hear from you this hour. Do you have any questions, any comments, any leaders you have in mind that embody strong leadership or another style of leadership? 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Archie Brown, an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and author of The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. You can join our conversation. What traits do you value in political leaders, and who do you think embodies those qualities? Are there non-governmental leaders who you think our politicians could learn from? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Tenzin on Facebook says examples of strong leaders are Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, and Nelson Mandela. Professor Brown, comment on that a bit. Some names here of non-elected leaders, though leaders in their own right for sure.
Yes, I think that this is leadership in a purer form. When somebody doesn't have patronage to bestow, doesn't have institutional power, and yet they can attract a vast following and influence people, that's leadership in a purer form than the leadership of somebody who's head of a government and has got lots of jobs to fill. So Gandhi is a great example. I mean, these were people who were great leaders. I wouldn't call them strong leaders, not strong leaders as I define it, because
right.
That means being, you know, concentrating all this power in your hands, and they didn't have that power, but they had huge influence. And Gandhi, Martin Luther King, these are fine examples. Nelson Mandela, before he became president, as a moral force and political force in South African society. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, also in South Africa, has shown tremendous leadership qualities. So I would stress I'm not against leadership, still less against inspirational moral leadership, but I'm against overmighty leaders who concentrate too much power in their own hands.
Let's take a call from Therese in Rock Falls, Illinois. Hi, Therese.
Hi, thank you. I want to speak out about this notion of a so-called strong leader in the U.S. and what that has meant in the U.S., which is militarily attacking other countries who didn't do anything to us. This has cost us dearly. I mean, it has financially laid to waste this country. You know, I think all our warmongering, the billions of dollars that went into it, and also that go into the secret black budget, has directly to do with the 08 housing bubble, as they called it, and all the homelessness and jobs bleeding out of this country. Basically, my view is like Ron Paul, we need to stop, we need to rein back and fix our own country. I mean, even in the Bible it says, take the log out of one's own eye before you try to take a splinter out of someone else's. And we have been spending all our money in a priority that has been terrible for the whole world.
Thanks.
Terrible for this country and the whole world.
Thanks for that call, Therese. You know, it brings to mind a question I've been meaning to ask this hour, Archie, which is, what kinds of questions should we ask ourselves as we're examining the types of political candidates that are presenting themselves as candidates for president or Congress or any other office for that matter? How can we discern what their leadership style might be beyond the words that they promise us on the campaign trail, and therefore the type of decisions they might make once they get into office?
I suppose that you know, one should look at the record. One of the curious things about American politics compared with European politics is that people can come from such different backgrounds to the presidency. In a European parliamentary democracy, every candidate for the highest political post would have spent a long time in parliament and would normally have been a minister, so you'd have a record you could look at. In the United States, of course, people can come from different walks of life, even from the military, in Eisenhower's case, or Congress, or a state governorship. But I would still look at their record there and take a decision on their judgment and look at what they've said about foreign policy, what they've said about domestic policy. Are they prepared to criticize vested interests, or are they under the thumb of vested interests? I think, you know, there's nothing to beat looking at the record.
Brian in Watertown is on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I believe that the Occupy movement has it correct and that we really don't need strong leaders at all. What we need are cheerleaders, people that can motivate the people to do the work instead of dictating policy.
Thanks, Brian. Professor Brown, do you have any examples of that, a cheerleader in office who empowers the people to get the work done?
Well, we've already discussed, you know, leaders who are not heads of government or heads of political parties who've shown terrific leadership qualities. You know, Martin Luther King clearly was enormously influential in the United States. Well, he had a very hard time, but he had a real impact, and in the long run as well as during his lifetime. So that's true leadership. The Occupy movement, I can understand their motivation and what they're arguing against, but a mass movement is not a substitute for political parties. And the fact remains that there's no country in the world today which is a democracy that doesn't have a competitive political party system. And so one has got to worry when political parties become weak or discredited. because there isn't really a substitute for them. Of course, to have movements other than political parties, to have civil society, political society movements, this can be very desirable, and it can provide a necessary jolt and impulse to political parties. But I wouldn't see non-governmental leaders being a substitute for governmental leaders, or a movement such as the Occupy movement being a substitute for a political party.
Mike and Racine, you're next. Hi, Mike. What's your question or comment?
The first thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I wanted to respond to the discussion about parliamentary democracies. You know, I couldn't disagree more, I guess, with one of the earlier callers. Parliamentary democracies are just as likely to develop a strong man, if you will. And, you know, we only have to go to our relatively recent history of countries like the Soviet Union and currently Russia. They have more of a parliamentary form than they do a form like ours, yet they have been able to spawn very tyrannical leaders that have pulled all the cards. You know, I think the issue really is, what is the traditions and culture that the government is being formed in? And in the case of the U.S., you know, we didn't really have a tradition. We rejected our founding fathers in the 1700s, rejected the pretty much everything British, and at least as far as a parliamentary form of government. And it took 100 years, or maybe a little bit more than 100 years, but we've developed our own tradition and culture, and that is going to be how our government's going to have to be based from now on. As long as we are a United States, it's going to have to be based on the traditions that we developed within our own country.
Thanks, Mike. And what's your response, Professor Brown?
Yes, well, I agree with a lot of that, but not everything that's just been said. I do agree that it's not really a problem of an overmighty president in the United States, because, as I've already emphasized, there are tremendous constraints on the American presidency. And I agree that, you know, culture is important, and one can contrast, you know, the culture of wanting to limit the powers of the top government official in the United States with Russia, where there's been a tradition of overmighty leaders going back for centuries. Where I would disagree was describing, you know, the Russian system as a parliamentary system. Technically, it's called a semi-presidential system. There is both a prime minister and a president, but the president is the presidency is the more important office, and parliament has become all the present Russian parliament's become almost as feeble as the old unreformed Supreme Soviet. So this is very far from being a parliamentary system, so not at all typical of European parliamentary democracies. Indeed, Russia today, I wouldn't call it a democracy. It's a kind of hybrid system in which there's been a creeping authoritarianism.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking with Archie Brown, an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and author of The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. We'll talk to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. A leader is not a governmental leader, but someone who I feel like has been a great leader, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, is Thomas Friedman from the New York Times. He's a columnist there, and he's generally seen as center-right, but has become kind of a champion for clean energy issues, and has, through his speaking tours and through his columns, has taken a big stand with his readership about investment in clean energy and investment in a more dispersed power grid that's able to meet the needs of the next century. And so I think done that by comparing us to other countries and some of the investments and advances they're making. And so you know, I think he kind of went against what you would generally see as his leadership as a generally center-right columnist, taking on what's generally seen as a liberal issue and being a champion for that. And so he's someone who I feel like is leading on an issue where the country and the world needs leadership right now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom. And
if I may come in there, I think that, you know, newspaper columnists do indeed have an opportunity to give a lead. They're very fortunate, you know, in having a regular forum of that kind. Some of them do in fact a great job. And I can think of examples in this country. It wouldn't be familiar to American listeners, but Yes, the general point I agree with.
What obligation, if any, do people like Thomas Friedman or other columnists or people who have a wide audience in that manner and therefore an influence, what obligation do they have to engage with our political leaders to try to bring about some of that redefinition or transformation that we've been talking about this hour?
Well, I would say they do have an obligation, and they have an obligation not to be too uncritical. I think in retrospect, the American mass media would recognize that they were too uncritical in the lead-up to the Iraq War. They accepted at face value a lot of what the administration said, and there was more criticism in this country, and even at the outset of the Iraq War, opinion was pretty well evenly divided in Britain, for or against, whereas in the United States it was overwhelmingly for initially. It's not now, but initially it was overwhelmingly for, and that partly reflected the relatively uncritical response of the mass media to what the administration were saying.
Let's take a call from Syed in Brookfield. Hi, Syed, how are you?
Yes, good morning, Cynthia, and good morning, Professor.
Morning.
My question might be not as sophisticated, but it's more to really kind of talk about the psychology of power and how our leaders get isolated when they get elected to office and they get surrounded by other people with power and opposing power, and how that, you know, that isolation and being away from family ties, being away from families for long periods of time removes that moral essence of humanity from politics and the decisions that they make that are detrimental to, you know, lives in wars and killings, mass killings, and, you know, again, the ones that really remove us from our emotions and, again, essence of, you know, family and human values.
Yes, I think that you certainly got a point that it's too easy for leaders to become remote from ordinary people. They're surrounded by people who are taking care of them all the time and are, on the whole, deferential to them. And so a lot depends on the character of the leader there. Some leaders make a point, including some presidents, of reading letters from ordinary people. They can't reply to them all personally, obviously, but reply to some of them and read quite a few of them. And again, if you look at parliamentary democracies, then they meet very severe criticism from opposition parties in their own legislature. So they're brought down to earth several times a week. In the United States, no one could say that President Obama is given an easy ride by the Republican Party or by some of the mass media. So I think it's in a democracy, leaders are less likely to become remote and feel they're untouchable than they are in an authoritarian regime where, of course, all criticism of the leader is banned.
In our last 30 seconds here or so, as we look at the 2016 elections here in the United States, we're already looking at candidates popping up. Are you optimistic that people will come to value other traits in their leadership?
I hope so. I'm not so much optimistic as, you know, aspiring to have some influence on the way people look at leaders and not look at strength and might as the crucial quality we should look for in leaders. I'm not sure whether I'm optimistic or not. I'm just doing my best.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Archie Brown is an emeritus professor of politics at the University of Oxford and author of the new book, The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing The Hour and to Bill Martins for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.